In 2011, the Tohoku earthquake struck the Japanese coast. It was the fourth biggest recorded earthquake in the world since 1900 and the worst in Japan since modern instruments were first used 130 years ago. The earthquake and the tsunami it triggered led to shocking damage, loss of life, loss of property, all sorts of aftermath issues. But as shocking as the damage was, the earthquake itself wasn't all that surprising. Seismologists, the scientists who study earthquakes, they know a great deal about where they're likely to occur and how serious they're likely to be. According to the USGS, that's the United States Geological Survey, roughly 500,000 earthquakes happen around the world every year. Only a select few make us sit up and take notice. Japan, unfortunately, is one of the places where those select few tend to occur. So how good are we at predicting the next big earthquake? How good are we at prediction in general? Predicting the future is almost impossible. That said, human beings are practically addicted to prediction. And with something as serious as earthquakes, you can't blame them. That's what the Japanese earthquake sounded like as recorded beneath the ocean's surface by Japan's Agency for Marine Earth Science and Technology.
We walk in there, not a good idea.
Just watch where you step.
Okay, you go first.
A while back, I visited the USGS office in Menlo Park, California. It sits just a few miles from the San Andreas Fault, the most serious earthquake threat in this country. I wanted to talk to a geophysicist about earthquake prediction. I knew they had a machine there in the lab.
Okay, so describe just where we are.
So we're in one of the laboratories where we have a very large machine that simulates earthquakes. Now, this particular apparatus does something very interesting. It starts sliding slowly, initially in a small spot, and that slow sliding will grow to a critical size until an earthquake happens.
That sound you heard, that was actually the sound of the scientist slapping his hand on the machine. The real sound the machine makes is about like this.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I've got to admit, when I first heard about the USGS's earthquake simulator, I envisioned something a little more dramatic, some kind of amusement park ride or something, but it's just a metal frame a few yards across with a big slab of rock inside, and the frame is compressed by hydraulic pressure. The earthquake it simulates, then, is vanishingly small. But still, how does this sound translate into that? And how can that knowledge be used to predict the next big one, whether it's in Japan, in Chile, or in California?
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Meet the scientist who was good enough to talk me through the science of earthquake prediction.
My name is Bill Ellsworth.
Ellsworth is a geophysicist, and when we spoke, he was a senior researcher at the USGS. Now he's a research professor at Stanford University. Ellsworth is a genial guy, low-key and soft-spoken, in his 60s with eyeglasses and a trim white beard, bald on top. He looks like a guy who's very comfortable spending long days in the lab, digging into the earthquake data. But I wanted to know if he'd ever experienced a real quake.
The most exciting earthquake I'd been in was the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. And I was at the end of the workday, and I was closing down my computer, going home to enjoy the World Series.
Game three of the 1989 World Series.
I felt something that I'd never experienced before. It was a very low-frequency wave, but very large amplitude, large enough that you noticed something was going on. And I fortunately guessed that this was the P wave, or the fast running wave of an earthquake, and that the S wave, the strong shaking wave, was to come later. So I immediately got up, moved to the door frame in my office, braced myself there, and rode through the shear wave, which shook the building hard enough that you could hear things racking and moving. You could hear the beam shaking. You could hear things falling. As soon as the shaking had stopped, I walked, the lights were out. since we'd lost electrical power throughout the region, which meant that the high-tech digital telephones were dead. I walked down the hall where I knew there was an old-fashioned analog telephone and called my colleagues at the USGS headquarters back in Reston, Virginia, who were also getting ready to enjoy the ball game, and said our world has just changed. And indeed it had.
I'll tell you what, we have an earth.
I see you're wearing a wedding ring. You're married now, I guess. Were you married then?
I was indeed.
But the fact is that after the earthquake hit here, your first phone call was to your USGS seismology colleagues, not to your wife. Is that true?
It is true. She knew that when the earthquake hit someday that she wasn't going to see me for a while. But I did contact her shortly thereafter, and things were fine at home.
But that's what happens when you marry a seismologist and you live in Northern California, right?
I'm afraid so.
Ellsworth and his wife were all right after the Loma Prieta earthquake, or as some people remember it, the World Series earthquake. It killed 63 people in Northern California. The 2011 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami in Japan killed more than 15,000 people. There are all kinds of reasons to want to know as much as possible about the next big earthquake, be able to predict as much as you can, as accurately as you can. So that's what I asked Ellsworth about.
Where does the word prediction fall into this?
Well, we're interested in predicting three things about earthquakes. One is, where will they occur? The second is, how strong will they shake the ground when they do occur? And then the third question is, when will they occur? The first two are in pretty good shape, actually. The third one is the really tough problem.
And I'm guessing that when you go to a friend's house, there's a cocktail party, a barbecue. Is that what they want to know from you? Is it, Bill, when is the big one and how do I get out of here?
That's usually the question they ask. And in my response is usually that's a little bit like asking, should I be buckling up my seatbelt in my car just before the accident? Better to put it on ahead of time and better to be planning for, you know, how to drive safely and not worry about when something bad might happen. If you're prepared, you'll get through the event okay.
Do you feel that there's too much emphasis or too much attention paid to the prediction part of what you do?
It's always a very popular topic. If earthquakes are predictable, we don't yet know how to do it. And there's a good chance that they're not predictable.
Talk a minute about the belief among certain people that they are very good at predicting earthquakes.
I think there are many people who have the belief that they can predict earthquakes. And the real question is, can you show that you made a prediction before the fact and that that prediction can be tested in a scientific manner? We can certainly say that there's going to be a magnitude 5 earthquake in the world somewhere today. That's an easy prediction. We can probably say there's going to be a magnitude 6 earthquake in California in the next 100 years. That's a gimme. But in terms of making a prediction that is really testable, that's a much harder thing to do. One of the very interesting things that was done years ago, this was back in the days of telephone answering machines. We had a project that had a group of volunteers, people who had animals that were very sensitive to the coming of earthquakes. And the instructions were that when their animals acted up, they were to call the number and leave a message. There were never any messages left before earthquakes, but lots of messages left after earthquakes. And, oh, they had meant to call, but they didn't.
So in other words, moments before the earthquake, I noticed my cat was pacing back and forth.
That's the kind of thing, exactly, yeah.
We are speaking here at the USGS offices in Menlo Park, California, which is how far from San Andreas fault lines?
San Andreas is about 6 or 7 miles up the hill from us here. So we're living in earthquake country, definitely. We estimate that in the next 30 years, there is a better than 2-to-1 chance that we're going to be hit by a fairly major earthquake, like the one that hit in 1989.
Does it keep you up at night?
It doesn't keep me up at night. My house is 60 years old or so, and likely will have some damage if an earthquake strikes. I don't think it has any chance of collapsing. So I think we'll get through the earthquake okay. But it's a hazard that I feel I can live with.
You say that the odds that a serious earthquake will hit this area where we're sitting now by 2040 are significant. Damages would be significant, potentially loss of life significant. Yes, we're agreed on that?
We are agreed on that. And we've made some estimates based upon the repeat of a big earthquake on the Hayward Fault, and that would be really a very serious event. We'd be talking about many tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars in losses.
Do you ever just say, why the heck do people live in obvious potential harm's way? So we see with hurricanes that people have been flocking by the millions to the places where hurricanes happen a lot. California, which has probably more earthquake danger than any other state, I'm guessing, per mile, per capita, would that be true?
Well, we have the most exposure in terms of people who are exposed to earthquakes. You know, we have earthquakes that are just as severe in many, many other states. Perhaps what we have done a better job of in the West is adopting the codes that are necessary for structures to survive earthquakes. I could draw a parallel perhaps between two earthquakes with very, very different effects. Neither were within the U.S., but there was a magnitude 7 earthquake just outside the city of Christchurch in New Zealand. And this earthquake did tremendous damage to chimneys and things within the city. There were many older brick buildings that collapsed, but fortunately it occurred in the middle of the night and there were no lives lost. That earthquake is really no different in size and its severity than the one that hit Haiti. And look at the difference there. Engineering does work.
There are obviously big earthquakes and small earthquakes. The big ones are the ones that people hear about, the ones that people care about. How many earthquakes, however, are there in a given day around the world, let's say?
Well, we typically see an earthquake of about magnitude 6 once a week globally. And the way that earthquakes work, if you have one magnitude 6, you'll probably have 10 magnitude 5s, and you'll have 100 magnitude 4s and 1,000 magnitude 3s. And it just goes on and on down the Richter scale. So in a sense, the Earth has organized itself in an interesting way that the worst it does is in the biggest earthquake, but those are the rarest ones. So instead of being peppered with damaging earthquakes every day, we get the big one once a century.
We're in California where big earthquakes have happened and caused real damage in recent years and in faraway years. So talk to me a bit about what the future looks like here and how scared we should be.
Unlike the atmosphere, which, say, meteorologists work with, we can't see underground. And also, unlike the meteorological situation, we don't have satellites that allow us to map the system. We don't even really know the equations that govern the way that earthquakes work. And it turns out that the small earthquakes are one of the most important things that we can gather. They actually allow us to map out in space where the faults are. And from that, we can then begin to build these physical models that hopefully will lead to more accurate predictions in the future.
But did you just say that you don't really understand the equations that describe the way earthquakes work?
That is correct. We have...
I was starting to feel safer around you, and all of a sudden...
Well, we know a lot about how seismic waves propagate in the Earth. That we understand. But what actually happens on the fault the moment when the earthquake starts? What leads up to the occurrence of the earthquake, and how does that propagate? We've got some good models, but we don't have any other real samples of faults that are active today. So what people don't remember about science is you can't prove something is true, but you can prove that it's false. So we're always working in this duality of trying to build better theories, better models that can explain the natural world, but knowing that ultimately they're going to fail some test. The good models work well. The bad models go away in a hurry.
Should I move here? Will there be an earthquake here that is potentially devastating to us?
There's certainly a very good chance there would be an earthquake, but there's really no reason not to move here. Public schools are one of the safest places to be for your children.
Oh, so you're saying it's okay if they're in school, but I'm worried about them being on the weekend. I'm worried now.
So on the weekend, you need to think through what your hazard is. You should probably look at the house you live in as well and decide, is this one that's earthquake safe? Do I have things that are going to fall down and injure someone in bed? You spend a third of your life in the bed, make sure that nothing's going to fall on you there and kill you. Have a plan. These are the kind of things that we remind people to do. And if you take those very sensible steps, the earthquake problem is not going to be the most severe thing that you have to experience in your lifetime.
What is that?
I wish I knew, but it won't be that.
In 2010, there were a pair of very large earthquakes, one of which was wildly devastating in terms of property and life, the other one somewhat so, one in Haiti, one in Chile. And it seemed as though much of the world thought there was an earthquake epidemic upon us. Was there? Is there such a thing?
You know, we've looked at that question. Were there an unusual number of large earthquakes either this past year or the past decade? And the answer is no, that they're all within statistical norms. And it's when we have a couple of events in a row that impact society that we hear about it. There were bigger earthquakes that were out in the middle of the ocean that nobody ever heard of. So from a global perspective, we're not looking at a kind of a global earthquake cluster.
What has your work in seismology taught you about the human yearning for prediction in general?
Well, we love black and white answers, I think, and it's very difficult for people to grapple with concepts of probability. So if I say that there's a 100% chance that the sun is going to rise tomorrow, people will be pretty confident that that's going to happen. But if you tell them that simply by commuting in their car today, they've increased their risk of dying today by a factor of 1,000 as opposed to staying home, they have trouble grappling with that. It certainly doesn't freeze us out of our cars, but it indicates to me that you know, we have a long ways to go as human beings to understand low probability events and how to take effective and wise actions in the light of those.
There's something weirdly satisfying about hearing an expert say, without reservations, that the future is impossible to predict. In just about any realm you can think of, finance and politics, parenting, most experts will tell you that they have all the answers about the past, the present, and the future. It barely matters that they're often wrong, that they're only right about as often as a monkey with a dartboard would be right. What matters is that our thirst for prediction is so severe that we'll drink it up again and again and again. But a scientist like Bill Ellsworth, even with all the data at his fingertips and all the computer modeling money can buy, he admits that predicting earthquakes to some degree escapes him. I've got to say, I find some comfort in that admission. If the first step in dealing with a problem is admitting you have a problem, then maybe the first step toward predicting the future is admitting you can't, or something like that.
I wish that I could be decisive, then I'd understand where life is going for me. I wish that I could be decisive, then I'd understand where life is going for me.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we continue trying to look into the future with a tech pioneer who's seen things coming well before the rest of us.
Most of AI is going to be invisible to us. That's one of the signs of the success of a technology is it becomes invisible.
That's coming up on Freakonomics Radio. And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts, or at Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
All of us are constantly predicting the future, whether we think about it or not. Right now, some small part of your brain is trying to predict what this show is going to be about. Now, how do you do that? Well, you factor in what you've heard so far, what you know about Freakonomics, maybe know a lot, maybe you've never heard of it. You might think it's some kind of communicable disease. When you predict the future, you look for cognitive cues, for data, for guidance. Here's where I go for guidance.
I think to an economist, the best explanation for why there are so many predictions is that the incentives are set up in order to encourage predictions.
That's Steve Levitt. He's my Freakonomics friend and co-author, an economist at the University of Chicago.
So most predictions we remember are ones which were fabulously wildly unexpected, and then came true. Now, the person who makes that prediction has a strong incentive to remind everyone that they made that crazy prediction which came true. You look at all the people, the economists who talked about the financial crisis ahead of time. Those guys harp on it constantly. I was right, I was right, I was right. But if you're wrong, there's no person on the other side of the transaction who draws any real benefit from embarrassing you by bringing up the bad prediction over and over. So there's nobody who has a strong incentive, usually, to go back and say, here's the list of the 118 predictions that were false. And I remember growing up, my mother, who's somewhat of a psychic, would predict a stock.
Wait, somewhat of a psychic?
She's a self-proclaimed psychic. And she would predict a stock market crash every single year.
Right. And she's been right a couple times.
And she has been. She's been right twice in the last 15 years. And she would talk a lot about the times she was right. I'd have to remind her about the 13 times that she was wrong. And without any sort of market mechanism or incentive for keeping prediction makers honest, there's lots of incentive to go out and to make these wild predictions. And those are the ones that are remembered and talked about. Think about one of the predictions that you hear echoed more often than almost anyone is Joe Namath's famous pronouncement about how the Jets were going to win the Super Bowl. And it was unexpected, and it happened. Now, if the Jets had lost the Super Bowl, nobody would remember that Joe Namath made that pronouncement.
And conversely, you can probably find at least one player on every team that's lost the Super Bowl in the last 40 years who did predict that his team would win.
That's probably right. Exactly right. Now, the flip side, which is perhaps surprising, is that in many cases, the goal of prediction is to be completely within the pack. And so I see this a lot with pension fund managers or endowment managers, which is if something goes wrong, then as long as everybody else made the same prediction, you can't be faulted very much.
Pension managers, football players, psychic moms, Romanian witches. Who doesn't try to predict the future these days?
Go ahead and make your predictions. Well, start with the Masters.
I'm going to lean towards Phil. I like his new putting stroke.
The old Farmer's Almanac predicts a colder than usual winter.
Bear Stearns is fine. Do not take your money out. This is real. Look, if there's one takeaway, Bear Stearns is not in trouble.
Randy and Freddie are fundamentally sound, that they are not in danger of going under.
Paul the Octopus is making yet another World Cup prediction, betting on Spain.
We will in fact find evidence of weapons programs.
Gaddafi will ultimately step down.
When you try to envision the future, what do you see? Do you see a grim picture? A world, perhaps, in which humans have become marginalized, where technologies created to help us have gained the upper hand?
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
The film industry takes a rather dim view of the future, doesn't it?
Indeed. I can't think of a single Hollywood movie about the future on this planet that I want to live in.
Kevin Kelly was a pioneer of internet culture, a founding editor of Wired magazine. His vision of the future wasn't so bleak.
In the 50s and 60s, when I was growing up, there was a hope of everything after the year 2000. And that's the future that I remembered.
In the year 2000.
In a new book called The Inevitable, Kelly tries to see whether his youthful optimism squares with the technological realities of today and tomorrow. Short answer, yes.
On average, for the past 100 years or so, things have improved incrementally a few percent a year in growth. And while it's possible that next year that stops and goes away, the probable statistics view of it is that it will continue.
Kelly envisions a world where ever more information is available at any time, summoned by a small hand gesture or voice command. A world where virtual reality augments our view of just about everything, where artificial intelligence is seamlessly stitched into our every move.
Most of AI is going to be invisible to us. That's one of the signs of the success of a technology is it becomes invisible.
So invisible that without our even knowing about it, AI will read our medical imaging and approve our mortgages. It'll drive our cars, of course, and perhaps become our confidant.
So I think our awareness of it, for the most part, will be as a presence in our lives, and we take for granted very, very quickly, in the same way that we take for granted Google. People don't realize, I tried to stress to my son, you know, when I was growing up, you couldn't have your questions answered. You didn't ask questions because there was no way to get them answered. And now we just routinely ask dozens and dozens of questions a day that we would never have asked back then. And yet we just sort of take it for granted. And I think a lot of the AI will be involved in assisting us in our schedules, our days, answering questions as a partner in getting things done. So think of it as a GPS for your life, in the way that you kind of set your course in the GPS and then it's going along and it's telling you how to go, but oftentimes you're overriding it and it's not bothered by that. It's got another plan right away. And then you change your mind, oh, no problem. I got another one. I have another schedule here. I'll do this over here. I'll get this ready for you. I'll make this reservation. I'll buy this thing. No problem. You change your mind. No, well, I'll send it back. No problem. Kind of like having a presence that is anticipating and helping your life. I think that's what it looks like, even, I would say, within 20 years.
So we've done quite a few episodes of Freakonomics Radio that address the future, especially when it comes to the interface between technology and employment, the idea of whether there will be, quote, enough, end quote, jobs for people, whatever enough means. You write that, and I'll quote you, the robot takeover will be epic, which I'm sure will scare some people, and that even information-intensive jobs, doctor, lawyer, architect, programmer, probably writers and podcasters too, can be automated. So even if this is what the technology can and wants to accomplish, it strikes me that the political class may well try to stymie it. I'm curious your views on that.
Yeah, I mean, there was this really great survey poll that Pew did. Basically, they asked people how likely they thought that, you know, 50% of the jobs would be replaced by robots or AIs. And it was like 80% of people. And then they followed this up with how likely they thought that their job would be replaced. And like nobody believed that their job would be. And it was across the board. And I did the same exact survey, actually, in a crowd of people who came to my book party, 200 people. We had instant polling devices, and I asked the same thing. It was exactly the same pattern. Everyone believes that most of the jobs will be replaced, and no one believes that their job will be replaced. And I think it's actually neither. I think most of these, almost our jobs are bundles of different tasks, and some of those tasks, or maybe many of those tasks, will be automated, but they'll basically redefine the kinds of things that we do. So a lot of the jobs are going to be reinvented rather than displaced, particularly in the kinds of things we're talking about of the professional classes. I'm not saying that the AI can't be creative. It can be. In fact, we're going to be shocked. In some senses, we're going to realize that creativity wasn't so creative. Creativity is actually fairly mechanical, that we will actually be able to figure out how to have AIs be creative. But the thing is they're going to be creative in a different way than we are. I think probably the last job that the AIs or robots would do will be a comedian. I mean, they'll have a different sense of humor. They won't get us in the same way that we get us. Even though they'll be incredibly creative, they can be brilliant, they'll be smart, they'll surprise us in many ways, they're still not going to do it exactly like we do it, and I think we will continue to value that.
But that assumes, which is, if you watch a certain kind of futurist movie or read a certain kind of futurist book, that assumes that the artificial intelligence doesn't essentially obliterate or marginalize us. Yes?
Right. The question is whether an artificial intelligence that we create can only gain at our expense. And I think that while that's a possibility that we should not rule out, it's an unlikely possibility.
You write, Kevin, that this is not a race against the machines. If we race against them, we lose. This is a race with the machines. Talk about how that begins to happen, whether it's a shift in mindset, a shift in engineering. How does it happen that we come to view AI or robotization or automation or computerization as more of a continuing ally than a threat?
So one of the first AIs we made, which was a kind of dedicated standalone supercomputer, the IBM Deep Blue, who beat the reigning chess master at the time, Garry Kasparov. And this was kind of the first big challenge sort of to human exceptionalism, basically. And when Kasparov lost, there were several things that went through people's mind. One is, well, that's kind of like the end of chess. It's like, well, who's going to play competitively because the computers are always going to win? And that didn't happen. In a funny kind of way, playing against computers actually increased the extent in which chess became popular. And on average, the best players became better playing against the artificial minds. And then finally, Kasparov, who lost, realized at the time that he said, you know, it's kind of unfair because if I had access to the same database that Deep Blue had of every single chess mood ever, I could have won. And so he invented a new chess league. This kind of like the freestyle league, like a kind of free martial arts. You can play any way you want. So you could play as an AI, or you could play as a human, or you could play as a team of AI and humans. And in general, what's happened in the past couple of years is the best chess player on this planet is not an AI, and it's not a human. It's the team that he calls Centaurs. It's the team of humans and AI, because they're complementary, because AIs think differently than humans. And the same of the world's best medical dietician. Diagnostic is not Watson. It's not a human doctor. It's the team of Watson plus doctor. And that idea of teaming up is going to work because inherently AIs think differently, even though they're going to be creative, even though they'll make decisions, even though they'll have a type of eventually consciousness. It will be different than ours because we're running on a different substrate. It's not a zero-sum game.
And how much AI was applied to the writing of the book? I mean, obviously you spell check and things like that, but I'm curious if there's anything else.
Not as much as I would like, because AI has been around for 50 years and very slow progress, and that is because it was very, very expensive to do.
AI was expensive because good artificial intelligence requires a lot of data and a lot of what's called parallel processing power. But the cost has come down, an unexpected gift from the video game industry.
The reason why we have this sudden surge into AI right now in the last couple of years is because it turned out that to do video gaming, you really needed to have parallel processing chips. And they had these video chips, graphical processor units, that were being produced to make video gaming fast, and they were being produced in such quantities that actually the price went down and became a commodity. And the AI researchers discovered a few years ago that they could actually do AI not on these big, expensive, multi-million dollar supercomputers, but on a big array of these really cheap GPUs.
Add to that the fact that more and more objects are being equipped with tiny sensors and microchips, creating the so-called Internet of Things. As Kelly writes, in 2015 alone, 5 quintillion transistors, that's 10 to the power of 18, were embedded into objects other than computers. Which means we will be adding artificial intelligence as quickly and easily as people in the industrial era added electricity and motors to manually operated tools.
I believe people will look back at this time. We'll look back at the year 2016 and said, oh my gosh, if only I could have been alive then. There was so much I could have done so easily. And here we are.
But one area of technology isn't keeping up.
And that's batteries. I think a lot of this Internet of Thing, the idea that we take all your shoe and your clothes and the chair and the books and the light bulbs in your house and all of them are connected, I think part of what's holding that back is not the sensors and the chips intelligence, but the power. What I don't want to do is spend all my Saturdays replacing all the batteries and all the things in my house.
Predicting the future anytime in any realm is fairly perilous. You admit in your book that you missed a lot about how the internet would develop, for instance. So without meaning to sound like a total jerk, let me just ask you, why should we believe anything you're telling us today about the future?
Yeah, I think every futurist, including myself, is basically trying to predict the present. And so you should believe me to the extent that it's useful to helping you understand what's going on now. As much as possible, I'm not really trying to make predictions as much as I am trying to illuminate the current trends that are working in the world. These are ongoing processes. These are directions rather than destinies. These are general movements that have been happening for 20 or 30 years. And so I'm saying these things are already happening. They looks like they're going in the same direction. And so I might be wrong, and I probably will be wrong on much of it. But I think if you see what I'm seeing, I think you will agree that it's happening right now, and that can be useful to anybody who's trying to make something happen or make their lives better. Let me just give you a quick little parallel about what I mean by inevitable, which is the title of the book. I'm talking about long-term processes rather than particulars. And so imagine, you know, rain falling down into a valley. The path of a particular drop of rain as it hits the ground and goes down the valley is inherently unpredictable. It's a stochastic. It's not at all something you can predict. But the direction is inevitable, which is downward. And so I'm talking about those kinds of large-scale downward forces that kind of pull things in a certain direction, and not the particulars. And so I would say that in a certain sense, the arrival of telephones was inevitable. Basically, no matter what political regime or economic system that you'd have, you would get telephones once you had electricity and wires. And while telephones were inevitable, the iPhone was not. The species, the particular product or company wasn't. So I'm not talking about the particulars of certain inventions. I'm talking about the general forms of things.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, how good of a driver are you, really, compared to an autonomous car?
Even though there's a few people who die from robot cars a year, humans kill 1 million people worldwide a year, and we're not banning humans from driving.
And if you want to hear more conversations like this one, check out the Freakonomics Radio archive at freakonomics.com, on iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Not long ago, I got a text from a friend. It just said, "Have you read The Inevitable?" I thought, The Inevitable? What's that? I had no idea, but it sure sounded scary. Did North Korea finally bomb someone? But no, that's not what my friend meant. The Inevitable was the title of a new book by Kevin Kelly about the future. I do have to say, the title of the book sounds, to me at least, a little scary. And I'm wondering, were you trying to scare us a little bit or no?
No, I wasn't trying to scare people. I think people are scared enough as it is. I was trying to suggest, basically, what it meant literally, which is that we need to accept these things in the large form. And part of the message of the book, which is a little bit subtle, which is that large forms are inevitable, but the specifics and particulars are not, and we have a lot of control over those, and we should accept the large forms in order to steer the particulars.
One of the inevitable trends that Kelly points out is dematerialization, the fact that it takes so much less stuff to make the products we use.
Yeah, that's a long ongoing trend. The most common way is to use design to be able to make something that does at least the same with smaller amount of matter. An example I would give was like the beer can, which started off as being made of steel, and it's basically the same shape and size, but has reduced almost a third of its weight by using better design.
But you can see how this trend can snowball. Instead of 100 books on a shelf, I have one e-reader. Instead of 1,000 CDs, a cache of MP3 files, which I may own or, more likely, borrow from the cloud whenever I want them.
The current example would be the way that people are reimagining a car, which is a very physical thing, as a ride service that you don't need to necessarily buy the car and keep it parked in your garage and then parked at work, not being used, when you could actually have access to the transportation service that a thing like Uber or taxis or buses or public transportation give. So you get the same benefits with less matter.
But one of the things that's sitting in my recording booth is a hardcover copy of your book, The Inevitable. And it just strikes me as so weird that for a set of ideas that we're talking about today, that it is still published in classic dead tree format. And I'm curious whether
you felt that there was a little bit of a paradox in that, or are you happy to exploit technologies from previous generations for as long as they're still useful, even if in small measure?
So there's a couple things to say about it. Let me say the larger thing first, and then get to the specifics about the book. Most of the things in our homes are old technology. Most of the stuff that surrounds us is concrete, steel, electrical lights. These are ancient technologies in many ways, and they form the bulk of it. And they will continue to form the bulk of it. So in 50 years from now, most of the technology in people's lives will be old stuff. We tend to think of technology as anything that was invented after we were born. But in fact, it's all the old stuff, really. And so I take an additive view, and I had this surprise in my previous book, and many people have challenged it, but it's never successfully, and that is that there has not been a globally extinct technology. Technologies don't go away, basically. They just become invisible into the infrastructure. And so, yes, there will be paper books forever. They will become much more expensive, and they may be kind of premium and luxury items, but they'll be around simply because we don't do away with the old things. I mean, there are kind of like more blacksmiths alive today than there were ever before. More people making telescopes by hand than ever before. So lots of these things, they just don't go away. But they're no longer culturally dominant. And so that's, paper books will not be culturally dominant. And in fact, this book, The Inevitable, it has digital versions.
I'd love you to talk for just a couple minutes about the ongoing need for maintenance, even when the technological infrastructure we're building and using every day wouldn't seem to be as inherently physical and in need of maintenance as the old infrastructure.
Yeah, that was a surprise to me. I changed my mind about my early introduction to the digital world. There was the promise of the endurable nature of bits, that you, when you made a copy of something, it was perfectly exact copy. And there was a sense that there's no moving parts, you know, kind of like a flash drive thing. There's no moving parts, it will never break. But it turns out in a kind of weird way that in more ways than we suspected, the intangible is kind of like living things. It's kind of like biology in the sense that it's so complicated and interrelated inside that things do break, and there are little tiny failures, whether it be inside a chip, a particular bit, that can have cascading effects and that can actually make your thing sick or broken. And that was a surprise to me, that software would rot, that computer chips would break, and that in general, that the amount of time and energy you'd have to dedicate to digital intangible things was almost as equal to the physical realm, was a surprise to me, and I think a lesson for us into the future.
Did it change how you think about running your own technological life? You write that you used to be one of the last guys to update everything because, you know, I got used to things the way they are. I don't need the update or the upgrade. And how has that changed how you do it now?
Yeah, well, I learned by being burned, by experience, by waiting till the last minute to upgrade, that it was horrible and that it was more traumatic in the sense that when I did eventually upgrade, I had to upgrade not just the current system, but everything else that it touched, forming this sort of chain reaction where upgrading one thing required upgrading the other, which required upgrading the other. And that when I did these calculations and changed my mode and tried to upgrade pretty fast, as soon as, you know, maybe not the very first rep, but the next one after that, that it was actually kind of, it was like flossing. It was like hygiene. You just sort of wanted to keep up to date because in the end, you actually spent less time and energy. It was less traumatic and you gained all the benefits of that upgrade. And so there is a sort of digital hygiene approach to things that I take now. And that's not the only way that I change. I also realized that the purchase price is just one of the prices that you pay when you bring something into your life. That there is this other thing that you actually do have an ecosystem, even in your household, even in your workplace, whatever it is. And that bringing something on, you're now committed to tending it.
When you're talking about bringing something into your home, I thought the one product that I've seen that number, they usually call it like cost of ownership, I guess, is cars. And I don't think it's the car manufacturers themselves who calculate that for you. Maybe it is. I don't know. But you do see this car, here's what it's going to actually cost you over its lifetime in terms of how much fuel it uses versus another car, how much maintenance it will require versus another car, because of the high-end components that it may have, what the cost of replacement will be for those. And I like that, but I want that calculation attached to everything. I want that calculation attached to the people that come into my life, even.
I think you're onto something. I think this idea of calculating the cost of ownership for digital devices or software apps, for that matter, would be very, very valuable and would not actually be that hard to derive because, you know, everything is being kind of logged in some capacity.
By looking deeply into the present, Kelly sees a future where more and more of our moves are being tracked, whether because of data we voluntarily make public, as on Facebook, or otherwise.
Inevitably, we will be tracking more and more of our lives and we'll be tracked more and more, and that's inevitable. And what we have a choice about is the particulars of how we do that, whether we do that civilly or not. We have to engage this. I was maybe a little bit frustrated by the fact that there's often an initial reaction from many corners of trying to prohibit things before we know what they are. And that's called the precautionary principle, which says simply that there are things that we should not allow in our lives until they're proven harmless. And I think that doesn't work.
Has that ever happened with a major invention, period?
That we proved that it was harmless?
Yeah, before it being, you know, let's say widely adopted.
In general, no, I don't think that there has ever been that. And I think it's kind of unfair to request it, but it does seem to be a current motion, like, in, say, in the genetically modified crop area. So people saying we can't have these because we can't prove that they're harmless. And so there are attempts to do that with AI driving, a robot car, which saying, no, you can't have robot cars on the road until we prove that they're completely safe. And that's not going to happen. And that's unfair because even though there's a few people who die from robot cars a year, humans kill 1 million people worldwide a year. And we're not banning humans from driving.
In the future that you envision, who are the biggest winners and losers?
I think it's all comparative. I think there will certainly be people who gain more than others, and to them, who only gain a little, that might seem that they lost. But I suspect that everybody will be gaining something, and perhaps the poorest in the world will continue to gain the most over time. But there will be people who won't gain as much as many others. I don't want to call them losers, but those people, I think, are going to, by and large, be those who will be unable to retrain or unwilling to retrain. And I think retraining or learning is going to be kind of like a fundamental survival skill, because it's not just the poor who have to be retrained. I think even the professionals, people who have jobs, who are in the middle class. I think this is going to be an ongoing thing for all of us, is we are going to probably be changing our careers, changing our business card, changing our title many times in our life. And I think there will be the resources to retrain them. Whether there's a political will, I don't know. I kind of take a Buckminster Fuller position, which is that if you look at the resources, they're all there. There's enough food for everybody. The reason why there's famine is not because there's enough food, but it's because there isn't a political will to distribute it.
And it only takes one bad actor to ruin the livelihood of a couple hundred thousand or million people. That's a leverage that exists, you know, even in humans. Forget about machines.
Exactly. So I think this technology is going to benefit, or can benefit, everybody. But whether they do or not, whether specifically whether they do, that is a choice that we have to make and will make a huge difference. So in an abstract sense, I think this technology does not necessarily make losers, but that doesn't mean that there won't be, because I think we do have choices about how we make things specifically. The internet was inevitable, but the kind of internet that we made was not, and that was a choice that we make whether we made it transnational or international, whether it was commercial or nonprofit, those choices are choices that we have. Those choices make a huge difference to us. And so I think inherently the technology has the power to benefit everybody and not make losers. But that's a political choice in terms of the particulars of how it's applied. And therefore, I think we do have to have those choices.
It also seems, just out of fairness to your argument, really, that just as you can't foresee all the benefits of what technology will give birth to, nor can you see the downsides, right? I mean, there's just no way for any one of us sitting here now to see what that's really going to be.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Yeah, right. We've never invented a technology that could not be weaponized. And the more powerful a technology is, the more powerfully it will be abused. And I think this technology that we're making is going to be some of the most powerful technology we've ever made. Therefore, it will be powerfully abused.
And there's the scary part of the Kevin Kelly view of the future.
Exactly, right. But here's the thing. Most of the problems we have in our life today have come from previous technologies. And most of the problems in the future will come from the technologies that we're inventing today. But I believe that the solution to the problems that technology created is not less technology, but more and better technology. And so I think technology will be abused, and that the proper response to those abuses is not less of it, to prohibit it, to try and stop it, to turn it off, to turn it down. It's actually to come up with something yet even better to try to remedy it, knowing that that itself will cause new problems, knowing that we then have to make up new technologies to deal with that. And so what do we get out of that race? We get increasing choices and possibilities.
All right, Kevin Kelly, one last question. You argue that technology is prompting us to ask more and better questions, advancing our knowledge and revealing more about what we don't know. You write, it's a safe bet that we have not asked our biggest questions yet. Do you really think that we haven't asked, I guess, the essential human questions yet? What are they? And I ask that, of course, with the recognition that if you knew the answer to that question, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Well, what I meant was we're moving into this arena where answers are cheaper and cheaper. And I think as we head into the next 20 or 30 years, that if you want an answer, you're going to ask a machine, basically. And the way science moves forward is not just by getting answers to things, but by then having those answers provoke new questions, new explorations, new investigations. And a good question will provoke a probe into the unknown in a certain direction. And I'm saying that the kinds of questions that, like, say, Einstein had, like, what does it look like if you sat on the end of a beam of light and you were traveling through the universe in the front of a light? Those kinds of questions were sort of how he got to his theory of relativity. There are many of those kinds of questions that we haven't asked ourselves. The kind of question you're suggesting about what is human is also part of that, because I think each time we have an invention in AI that beats us at what we thought we were good at, each time we have a genetic engineering achievement that allows us to change our genes, we are having to go back and redefine ourselves and say, well, wait, what does it mean to be human, or what should we be as humans? And those questions are things that maybe philosophers have asked, but I think these are kind of questions that almost every person is going to be asking themselves almost every day, as we have to make some decisions about, is it okay for us to let a robo-soldier decide who to kill? Should that be something that only humans do? Is that our job? Do we want to do that? They're really going to come down to like dinner table conversation level of like, what are humans about? What do we want humans to become? What am I as a human, as a male, as an American? What does that even mean? So I think that we will have an ongoing identity crisis personally and as a species for the next, at least forever.
Mm. So I have to say, for all this talk of technology and the future of technology, you have weirdly made me feel a bit more human. And for that, I thank you.
You know, you're not a robot because you ask such great questions.
The true test will be how I do at comedy, though, correct?
Exactly. And you laughed at my joke, so we know that you're alive as a human.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.